I called an audible this week, and John 4 is no longer our topic for discussion this evening. So we will be singing at the end, There's a Fountain Free, and I appreciate you thinking ahead on that one, but we're not going to be talking about the living water or the well or anything like that tonight, but we will revisit that. Tonight I want you to turn, please, if you will, to Luke chapter 14. We'll just use this text briefly to introduce our subject tonight. And I want you to imagine, as you do that, that you have decided that you would like to host a dinner party, a great dinner party. And so you get your guest list out, and you go to a lot of trouble to get your guest list just right, and you go to a lot of planning and prep work and cleaning and a lot of expense, of course, for this as well. You get a lot of people excited about this, and they're talking about it, and all of a sudden, right before it starts, you start to get these calls, these cancellations. Then there's one, and then there's another over here, and you begin to panic a little bit that you've got all this, you've done all this work, and we're reasonable people about that, right? I mean, we understand. I've had to cancel. You want people to understand. And there are excuses that we will accept, right? I mean, oh, you're sick? I'm so sorry to hear that you're sick. We don't want you here. You know, just stay home, get better, that sort of thing. It might be, God forbid, somebody's died. Okay, yeah, we totally understand. We get that. You know, somebody might call them being held hostage. Yeah, we get that. But it's got to be a good excuse, right, if we're going to accept it. You can't just decide at the last minute, we got a better offer and think everything's going to be okay there. The matter of excuses when there's been an invitation is the subject of consideration in Luke chapter 14. Again, just an introduction to our study. You're not going to spend a lot of time here. But in the same vein, there's been a great invitation for a great supper by a man who invited many to it. And when this invitation went out, it says in verse 18 that those who were invited, they all with one accord began to make excuses. And I want you to notice with the three excuses that are given, just how sorry they are. Just to the core, how illegitimate and meaningless they are. The first said, I have bought a piece of ground and I must go and see it. I ask you have me excused. Is there anything wrong with that in your mind? Just look at what is said there. It doesn't say there is this prime piece of property that is not going to be there tomorrow. I've got to do this right now. This is such a, you'll understand, right? It doesn't even say that. He says, I have bought a piece of land and I want to go see it. So it's like, I already own it, but what's he really saying there? I would rather go look at my plot of dirt. I would rather walk around and look at dirt than come over to your house. The next said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm going to test them. I ask you have me excused. So, same sort of argument there. These have already been purchased and he wants to go test them. Now, there's something wrong with this man's intelligence anyway, because he's got this out of order and that he's testing them after he's bought them. You'd have to be a fool to turn down this invitation. So it fits in context. But we're just establishing here that these people, in their excuse making, are not very sound. And what we've seen already so far is that people will miss wonderful opportunities because of earthly concerns. I just love how well that fits. Earthly concerns in the first case, and in the second case, their business, their pursuit of excellence, their desire for money and things will crowd out and take precedence over the things of God. So earthly concerns, business concerns, I have to work, that sort of thing. And then verse 20, where we're going to see family concerns will sometimes take precedence when they shouldn't. Still another said, I have married a wife and therefore I cannot come. We always ask, well, what is the therefore? And I ask that question and I still don't understand, because to me the therefore doesn't belong.
It's a conclusion that doesn't of necessity need to take place. You've married a wife, great. She's welcome. I mean, did you even stop to ask whether or not you could bring your new wife? And did you stop to consider whether or not that would be a wonderful time? Or that maybe you're about to eat better than you'd ever eat if you just took your wife out on your own, or whatever the case might be. That doesn't follow. None of these excuses were of any significance. What I wanted to do tonight was to make a list. I've compiled a list of just the things that I have experienced in all the conversations that I have with people. You go through many lessons with people. You introduce them to Jesus. You tell them what they need to do to be saved. You go through all of the lessons that you have for them. And then there's inactivity on their part. There's indecisive. There's indecision. And you're just wondering, what's missing? What did I do wrong? For each person, it's different. Everybody seems, not everybody, but many people have their reasons, their excuse, and these are a list of six things that I've found in my experience that people are struggling with and the obstacles that they have to making that decision to follow Christ. In the audience tonight, there are at least two categories of people, those who are not Christians and perhaps struggling with at least one of these excuses. I know I did. One of them is mine. I might even reveal that to you. Secondly, there might be those in the audience who are Christians and they remember the struggle. And to these, I would say, give diligence to prepare your own answer to these things. What if you were sitting in a lesson with somebody and they offered one of these excuses to you? Challenge yourself as we go through these things to say to yourself, what would I say? How would I answer this? How would I disassemble this excuse and show it for what it really is? And in my estimation, in many cases, what it is a selfish provocation of the Lord. You'll notice in verse 21 of Luke 14, it says, "The servants came and reported these things to his master, and the master of the house, being angry, said to his servants." And so excuses have a great potential to provoke the Lord to anger. So the first excuse I wanted to address, and it might not come out in these words, but a lot of times the end result is the same. You see the inactivity on some people's parts, and it's because they fail to see that everything that you've been saying is something that applies to them, because in their view, they're thinking that condemnation, that judgment, that punishment for sin is something that is deserving of the really bad people. So they have this world, they have this view of those eternal issues that is not in keeping with what Jesus taught, where Jesus said there'll be few that find life. Their idea is that there will really be few really bad people that are going to be punished. But if you find yourself in that position, I'm a really good person, I just want to thank you for being a good moral person. The world needs more of you. I think we would all agree with that. I am thankful for the good moral person in the world. Unfortunately, the Lord doesn't need good moral people. Your good moral nature doesn't do it for the Lord. Because when it comes to the Lord's view, there are none who are good. Remember that? He said, why do you call me good? There is none good but one, God. And in Romans chapter 3, verse 10, he says that none are righteous, no, not one. All have fallen, have gone astray. All of them are unclean. That's Romans 3:10. None righteous, no, not one. No one understands, none who seeks after God. They've all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. According to man's judgment, though, of course, if we could judge ourselves based on man as the standard, we could find plenty of people that we could compare ourselves to and make ourselves feel better about ourselves. But of course, Scripture says not wise for us to do so. When we were going through James on our Wednesday night study, I came across chapter 2 and verse 10, and I found it to be pretty helpful for our study tonight. If you come across a good moral person, a person that says, "I'm okay, you're okay," which I've always loved the saying that says, you got Jesus on the cross with these thoughts that says, if you're okay, then what am I doing up here? But if you come across that person, think of James 2, verse 10, where he says that anybody who is guilty of even breaking one part, whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles in one point, he is guilty of all. So you think you're a good moral person. You don't think you need to respond. You don't think you need to do anything. You don't think you need to devote your life to God and obey the gospel. Then let me just ask you, have you ever told a lie? Have you ever lusted in your heart after something evil? Have you ever gossiped about something? There's just things that nobody could in the world say, I've never done that. And yet James clearly says that you could do everything perfectly. You could get a 99.9% on the test of life and stumble in one little detail, and now you owe a debt that you cannot repay on your own. And of course, we remember Cornelius, of course, who was a good, devout man, God-fearing, gave alms to the Jewish people, prayed to God continually, who was told that he had to hear words by which he and his household would be saved. I'm thankful for people like Cornelius in this world. I'm thankful for their conviction, and I want them to live next to me. But when it comes to the gospel, we all need it. Secondly, this is kind of an opposite to that, and an opposite extreme at that. And I'm just going to go ahead and tell you, this was me. And I think it affects people that were raised by Christian parents who, quote, grew up in the church. I think this is something that can be an obstacle, and that is this fear that you're not going to be good enough. That you got this gospel opportunity for the forgiveness of sins, but what then? What after that? Okay, I'm saved now. And there's this fear that maybe I won't succeed, or maybe I'll have failed Christianity, or somehow Christianity will fail to make the change that it is supposed to make in an individual. Of course, we can remove all doubt, therefore. We take away all doubt, all fear, and whatever is unknown about that, and assure you that indeed you will fail. You will sin. And that's exactly what the gospel is for, is because we sin. If anyone says he doesn't sin, then he makes God a liar. 1 John chapter 1, verse 8. But that doesn't mean you failed Christianity. It doesn't mean that Christianity has failed you. Because good seed produces good fruit. And sometimes you're not going to see the change until you give it enough time that you can look back on your life and see that following the Holy Spirit has produced in your life the fruit of the Spirit. And that's not going to happen overnight. But it's something that's going to require maturity and time. Until in Ephesians 4, verse 13, we come to this mature man that Paul talks about. He says, until we come to the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man and the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. This next excuse is one that I just hate when I come to, and it's very difficult. It's very hard, very emotional. It's not legitimate, but at the same time, it's very hard. And you can imagine if you've ever been in this position where you've been studying with someone and the light comes on and they recognize that if what you're saying is so, then they've got in their mind who they would then be sending, in their view, who they would be sending to hell. It's just the idea that they have the power to condemn their loved one to hell. And that is such an awful thing. I remind you of Luke chapter 14, verse 20, that reiterated this family element in the excuses that we sometimes make. Matthew chapter 10, verse 37. One of the things that I'd point out to this individual is that Jesus himself said that he will stand second place to no man and no relationship. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. So I try to point out when this comes up that I am not the judge. And we are not judges. And certainly we don't have the power by word or deed at all to change the eternal status of one who has already passed on. But even if, for argument's sake, if for argument's sake your greatest fear is realized and they didn't do what you are now convicted you need to do, then where are we then? Well, our present actions don't change the fate. We can't possibly change the fate of our dearly departed loved ones. If, God forbid, they are. I cringe every time I even have to talk this way, because I know how emotional it is for people. For me too. I have family that didn't obey the Lord. But if any are truly lost, then refusing to become Christians, you, right now, refusing, doesn't save them. The best you could hope for in that case, in some talk like this, is that there'll be some reunion in condemnation. Of course, Luke 16 addresses this. And you hate to have to point it out, but again, you're talking about a scenario that you're saying, even though we can't change a thing and what we do or say doesn't change a thing about that, if you want to go this route and talk about this, if you have a loved one that isn't with Jesus, then Luke chapter 16, that story, Luke chapter 16, 19 through 31, teaches that they don't want to have that reunion. What you see in that story is great fear that there would be that reunion. In fact, this would be the one opportunity where you could do something for them that they wanted to see take place. Remember the man, the rich man said, send someone so that they can warn my brothers that they not come here. So if it's really the family that you have in mind, if it's really the family you're worried about, the family's wish was that there not be a reunion, that would not bring joy. And when you imagine that to the final end, and you think of the day of that reunion, if there wasn't already wailing and gnashing of teeth to the nth degree, there would be at that point. You know what else we forget about when we let this stand in our way of doing what we see the scriptures are telling us to do? Yeah, we're thinking past tense about some dearly loved one, dear loved one that had passed on. But who are we not thinking about, even family-wise? If I'm willing to allow somebody who's passed to dictate whether I'm going to serve the Lord as I see the Scriptures teach me, would I be willing then to condemn my children who are going to most likely follow that example, or the grandchildren? You've seen in some cases where people have caused generation after generation of people to serve the Lord because of their decision to convert to Christianity. What about them? What about that flesh and blood? So, important considerations. Fourthly, there are hypocrites in the church. You've heard that, right? Of course, you hear this from time to time. And hypocrites, somebody who's putting on a show, they're wearing a mask, they are an actor. And you can see why that would repel people. That's not something that is comfortable to think about or talk about or have to deal with. But I wonder, is this going to stand up in the day of judgment when you come before God and He begins to, let's say for argument's sake, ask you about the consistency of your argument there? You're using as an excuse for not serving God the fact that some of His people are not what they claim to be. I can just imagine, being asked, are you consistent with that? When you at work and your coworkers begin to slander the boss, and you observe the boss come around and all of a sudden they became friendly and respectful and diligent, hard workers, that sort of thing. Did you walk off the job? Did you quit at that point? I just can't live in an environment where hypocrisy is going to take place. Or did you buckle down and do what you needed to do? You ever been out to eat with somebody? You got to your dinner guest there, and they're complaining about the quality of the food or the service. And then the waitress comes around and says, how's everything? That's fine. No, we're fine. We don't need anything. I wonder, in the same way, did you storm out of that restaurant? Just, I will not be party to people who are hypocrites. I don't think we do that, do we? But what is it about the church? It's like we're back at Luke 14 all over again. There's just an illegitimacy about the argumentation sometimes. We begin to expose these excuses for what they really are. And you know, have we forgotten that hypocrisy among the Lord's people is nothing new? Balaam was a prophet. Judas Iscariot was a prophet. Peter and Barnabas at times were hypocrites. I think I misspoke there. They were hypocrites. Hypocrisy was something that was very real. And yet, aren't you thankful that the other apostles didn't give up on them? Aren't you thankful that when Peter and Barnabas were observed to be hypocrites, that you didn't have John over there saying, this whole apostleship thing is just, they're a bunch of hypocrites. I'm out of here. Aren't you glad that they didn't write people up? Aren't you glad that Jesus, when he observed the same among his own disciples, didn't write them off? I like this saying, I would rather go to church for a few short years with hypocrites than go to hell with them forever. It's really about, you can't stand being around hypocrites. Well, you know where hypocrites are going to end up? If it's really about that, we need to work out our own salvation and worry about ourselves. Fifthly, this issue of procrastination. The idea that says, you know, I'm going to look into this real seriously. You've given me a lot of things to think about, and I just cringe because so often the thinking doesn't happen. An idea that's going to take place very soon, it doesn't happen. Many times it's much like in Acts 17, verse 32, where the Athenians and the Areopagus and the leaders there said, we'll hear you again on this matter. That was the gist of it. We'll hear you again on this matter. How different that was from Acts chapter 14 and verse 32, where it says, the people begged that these things might be spoken on the next Sabbath. Do you see the difference there? We'll hear you again. Please, please come and, oh, it'd be great. Will you come the next Sabbath? They set a specific time. They're begging that it would happen. Then you got the others that said, much like Felix, you know, when I have a more convenient time, I will call for you. Don't worry. I wouldn't dare dream of calling anyone else. You're my guy, Paul. You've really earned my respect. So I will call for you when that time comes. You know what a procrastinator has over the hypocrite at least? You gotta hand it to them. That at least they seem to be taking the demands of Christianity seriously. At least they're not like the hypocrite going ahead and say, well, yeah, I'll sign on that dotted line and then playing the part of an actor. Even still, there's no bonus points for that. No reward. The risk, of course, is evident. Tomorrow's sun may never rise. If all I had was a picture of that young man there, you would know surely who he was. Patrick Zamarripa, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He was 32 years old. I maintain that's really young. 32 years old. And he's just going about his business. All in a day's work. He's a bicycle cop, I believe. And can you imagine from out of the blue, you find yourself under sniper fire in downtown Dallas? You're talking to someone, and all of a sudden, somebody at a perch from however far away has got crosshairs on you. Do you think he expected that? I wonder if he'd had any Bible studies recently. I wonder if he had had any thought that someday he might need to also get serious about pursuing that. But he's young and healthy, and he wears bulletproof armor and has all the opportunities in the world, right? Finally, and this leads into our conclusion tonight, that is the question of timidity. I've experienced where some people are held back by the fact that they're afraid, especially in an audience like this, they're afraid of doing anything that would be in front of 200, 250, or sometimes even 300 people in our gatherings. I just don't know if I could come forward and talk in front of everybody or be put on the spot like that. And to them, I would just make sure that you understood that there is no such requirement. That the scriptures do not teach that it has to happen at the end of a service when the preacher gives his invitation. That this can happen, and you see examples from scripture. This can happen in the middle of the night. Request that you don't necessarily wait on purpose to do that, but it can happen in the middle of the night. And just like with the Philippian jailer in Acts chapter 16. The only thing that is necessary is that you be willing to confess your faith in Jesus Christ, that He's the Son of God. I understand the shyness point. I get that. I used to get sick. Just sick. In fact, I really can't believe I'm up here, because when I was younger, used to get physically sick about the thought of having to do this. Even in school, speech class, it was just an awful, awful thought. I get that. But at the same time, we're going to have to come to grips with the fact that it's about more than just me. My coming to the Lord is about so much more than just me. And I really need to take the focus off of me and how I feel. And I really just need to declare that Jesus is the Christ and be willing to confess Him before men. And I'm not afraid for you to know that I believe that Jesus is the Christ. So, lots of excuses. My own goodness, my fear of sinning, refusal to condemn my family. I'm turned off by hypocrites. I'm banking on tomorrow, or maybe I'm just too shy. Paul said in Romans 1, there's no valid excuse. None will be left with an excuse. And we saw in Luke 14:21 that excuses angered the Lord. Just as Ecclesiastes chapter 5 says, lest we anger the Lord because of our excuses. I know I'm speaking to some tonight. There are those in the audience who are not yet Christians, and I don't know if I've touched on or even came close to any of your excuses. There were a few extra that I decided not to talk about tonight. Whatever it is, I want you to, if you would, confront those and consider, what is it really? What is it really? We've got people who have been attending with us for a long time that need to confront the question, what is it that's really keeping me from serving the Lord? And if you'd like to talk about that with anybody, I'd be happy to help. I know Chuck would. Any of our elders, plenty of people here would be happy to help you with that. If you are a Christian, again, I challenge you to prepare your answer on these things. Be prepared to say, what would I say to somebody who confronted me with that sort of excuse? Please do it before it's too late. And if you're subject to the invitation tonight, we invite you at this time to come forward while we stand and sing.